Hello and welcome back to the Edge of the Box podcast, a podcast by WhoScored.com in association with Ultimate Fan. It's a huge weekend of Premier League football at the top of the table this week, so we are here to preview Liverpool versus Manchester City and an even bigger game at Villa Park as Aston Villa take on Tottenham in the battle for Champions League football. I'm joined by Ali Maxwell and first Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, did that sentence make sense? I said first Jonathan Wilson, but I'd already said Ali Maxwell, but I guess I was coming to you first, so it kind of does make sense.
Quite professional, actually. I think I've heard some of the biggest names in broadcasting do things like that, Dan. Slick.
Ali, good to have you back on again. We've just been talking about it for 15 minutes before we started, but if anyone follows you on social media, well, people do follow you on social media, they will have seen your header and the passion that ensued afterwards.
Yeah, there's always a chance that you will go viral on social media in this day and age, and you just hope it's for something like doing a massive meaty header when you're in the away end at Leighton Orient, rather than anything much worse and much more embarrassing than that. Yeah, one of the best moments of my adult life, Dan, so thank you for bringing it up. I will never tire of talking about it. Big, high clearance, and as soon as he booted it, I knew it was coming straight to me, and I knew exactly what I had to do. So just pleased to get a very good connection and enjoy it, to bask in the glory.
Honestly, it was unbelievable. I was so happy for you. I was so pleased, so pleased to see it. Absolutely lovely scenes. Let's talk about Liverpool and Manchester City then. But I could talk about Ali's header all day, but let's talk about the Premier League instead. And Jonathan, the first thing on my list here is that Joe Gomez has been playing in midfield the last few games. Never really thought of him as being a ball-playing centre-half. I'm not saying I thought he was bad on the ball, but I've never thought of him as being this excellent, all-encompassing, ball-spraying centre-half. But he's actually doing a really good job in there. And actually, wherever he's played this season, I think he's fitted in quite well. Like, he's come in from fullback and gone into the midfield a few times, but he's actually playing in midfield at the moment. But you don't look like you agree at all.
Well, he played in midfield against Forest. Much he's played there. Something that started there, I don't think, any other game.
He came on in the cup final and played there, I guess. That was a long time.
So there may have been bits and bobs of other games where he's ended up there. But, I mean, he's doing that because Liverpool, I mean, their injuries have eased a bit. But, you know, he's doing that because of injury. I don't think anybody sees that as his long-term position.
No.
I think where he's been incredibly useful for Liverpool is he can play anywhere across the back four. You know, he can play at centre-back, he can play at right-back. He's played pretty well at left-back this season. He can't score goals from any position, which is, you know, always nice to see that kind of player can still thrive. and you know, that level of versatility means he can play in midfield. And I guess that suggests a very good understanding of space on the pitch, that he can adapt. It makes him hugely useful as a squad player. I guess maybe that's a little tick beside his name for Gareth Southgate come summer, but that can't be England's first choice. To play a bloke who started one game in the league in midfield, yeah, that's not what's going to happen. I mean, I know Calvin Phillips has had a pretty rough time, but whether it's Calvin Phillips, whether it's Jordan Henderson, at the minute, neither you'd say is a great option to play alongside Declan Rice. Unless Joe Gomez starts playing the back midfield every game from now to the end of the season, that's not even part of the debate.
No, but he could be a versatile squad option, Ali, couldn't he? I mean, he has performed well this season. England have got Gay injured at the moment. He may not make the squad. He would have been in the squad, I think it's safe to say. And with the midfielders that Jonathan's mentioned as well, the fact that it's a 23-man squad as well, he could be a decent option in the squad.
Yeah, I think initially I thought to myself, while versatility is obviously, as Jonathan described it, a tick in the box, even though it's 23-man rather than 26-man, like, England shouldn't really need to be selecting players for versatility reasons. Like, as Jonathan's alluded to, Gomez, if he takes to the field for England in the Euros, you know, it'll be probably at left back or very unlikely to be at right back. So, I don't know. There's no point making a decision for versatility reasons. However, I do think it'd be a good idea to call him up for the March fixtures and just see what he looks like in an England team. The other point to make is that he's played for Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp for so long that, you know, he is a very calm and composed and controlled player, both with and without the ball. But that doesn't always translate to international football, where he hasn't played for England for over 3 years. So I think it'd be a good idea to call him up for the March fixtures. You know, as you mentioned, Gahey's out, but so are Luke Shaw, Reece James, Harry Maguire, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Tomori's been out recently, Konsa's been injured recently, Rico Lewis isn't playing for City at the moment, Ming's obviously out the equation completely. So there's definitely a chance for Gomez, and I think it'd be worth him getting that chance in March and seeing how he goes.
I'll tell you what, you recited that list of injured players absolutely perfectly. I was waiting for you to forget Tyrone Mings, and I was gonna shoehorn him, but you did it. And staying with the centre back theme, Jonathan, would you say that Konate and Van Dijk are the league's best partnership at the moment, according to Who Scored? They are, or could you argue, make a case for Gabriel and Saliba, who are actually fourth in the duos list for Who Scored?
Look, they're really, really good. I think there's quite a few good centre-back pairings this season. So, yeah, Gabriel and Saliba, obviously, I mean, Arsenal have the best defensive record in the Premier League, which is a useful gauge.
Probably no, I think they're the best, personally.
I think Diaz and Stones. I mean, Ruben Diaz hasn't had the best season, but maybe that's because Stones has been out for so long. And yeah, you know, their partnership last season was so good that I don't think you can write them off. And again, I know it's been disrupted by injury, but Botman and Cher at Newcastle, I think, have been really good together. And then you know, there's also kind of, especially with defenders, it's really hard to compare the top of the league to the bottom. So you look at Tarkowski and Branthwaite at Everton. I mean, Everton have the fourth best defensive record in the league, which, given how bad they are generally, yeah, I think that's a decent shout as well. So, yeah, they're clearly very, very good. I'm just not sure it really profits anybody to sort of decide who the best is, which I know is terrible for discussions, but
yeah. But that's not really
at least I've played along with the spirit of it by naming four other pairs.
Well, actually, you've done well because you've named Tarkowski and Branthwaite, and they're actually second in the centre-back duo list for Who Scored across the entirety of the Premier League in 23-24. So we've got Van Dijk and Konate at one, Tarkowski and Branthwaite at two, then Romero and Van de Ven. Then in fourth, it's Gabriel and Saliba. Dawson and Kilman are fifth, Bolly and Murillo sixth, Diaz and Akanji seventh. Then we've got Van Heck and Dunk, Pinnock and Collins, which I find farcical because I think Collins has had a terrible season. And then Colwill and Silva have come in at number 10. I guess for each team, they're the duo that have played together the most. But just talking about Konate and Van Dijk, Ali, I always think a good centre-half partnership is where they both kind of do good at different things. And I always kind of get that vibe with Konate and Van Dijk.
Of course, yeah, probably more than any other position on the pitch. It's about the collective, and it's about when you add the two players together, or three in the case of a back three, you know, do you have a really good whole, if you like? And clearly that's the case with Van Dijk and Konate. Konate feels like clearly established as Van Dijk's better centre-back partner, even though Matip played a lot of football in the start of the season. In fact, their last game against City, it was Matip, not Konate, that played against Van Dijk. And, you know, Haaland in that game had, I think, five shots, two on target, and scored a goal. So that's the target to beat for this two in this game. I just think it's so difficult to compare, partly because team style is a huge function on how centre-backs look and how they play. Tarkowski and Branthwaite are defending their box magnificently, and that is their primary function. For Van Dijk and Konate, their primary function is to deal with incredibly awkward situations that most centre-backs hate and struggle with, and that is defending a lot of space, defending counter-attacks without a lot of support, a lot of structure around you and in front of you. And they do that brilliantly well, don't they? Konate has really thrived, I think, defending the counter-attack this season. So, you know, they have that projection of strength and quality as well, which goes a long way to making everyone around them feel confident. And that's similar to Arsenal's duo as well. So, yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating to see how they deal with Haaland on the weekend. He's probably, you know, he has got a lower goal return this season, doesn't he? I think if we're talking about people that have kept him quiet, to use that phrase, only Arsenal early on in the season, and then Wolves, that was in back-to-back games where they lost both, game week 7 and 8, and he was pretty quiet in those games. But generally, it's tough to keep him entirely quiet.
Do you want to have a guess when he last scored a header, Haaland?
Paul, that's a niche question. Where's that come from?
three. My column last week, if you actually read me.
It's too highbrow for me, Jonathan. I can't be reading that.
Was it on TikTok at all? Because that's where Dan gets it.
I'm not on TikTok, so I'm too old for TikTok. I'm somewhere in the middle of these two things.
I'm going to say January the 3rd. Probably didn't even play that day.
I'm going to say last season, April.
Okay, well, if you split the difference, you get it about right. So wisdom of crowds. It was last October in the Manchester Derby.
It
was incredible. He's missed a load of headers, and obviously there was that chance on Sunday which he went for with his foot. Maybe he could have gone for with his head. But yeah, he's just stopped scoring headers, which is a bizarre thing. And you know, if you look at the list of non-penalty goals minus XG, which is, you know, it's not a perfect metric, but it's a decent sort of rough gauge of how efficient strikers are. Going into the weekend, he was 543rd out of 551 in the Premier League. I assume he'll have popped up slightly high because of getting the goal. But you know, he's not scoring as many goals as he perhaps ought to, given the chances he gets. I mean, look, it's also true that great goal scorers miss a lot of chances as well. I think he and Ollie Watkins are maybe the top two for big chances missed this season. And, you know, they're the top two scorers. So you can't really criticise that much. But Watkins is much higher than that list of 551. Darwin Nunez is down there. And then perhaps more predictably, Dominic Calvert-Lewin is down there.
Yeah. I thought, am I right in thinking that Haaland didn't score at Anfield last season and they won 1-0? Salah scored. Was that last season? Am I right in thinking that? No one knows. Ali reeled off the list of every centre-back that's available for England, but he can't remember that score.
I mean, this is what, something like the 20th game between these two last 6-7 years. They've all kind of blurred into one for me.
I'm sure they won 1-0 last season. Liverpool, Salah scored, and then I'm sure Haaland was really, really quiet in the midst of a goal-scoring run, but I could be remembering that.
No, you're completely correct. A 76th minute goal for Salah.
Oh, here we go. Come on, the brain. Come on, the memory. Maybe I should start reading Jonathan's columns. Maybe I am up there. Ali, how big... I mean, to be fair, we've got straight into talking about Liverpool without actually addressing how big this game is. Ali, this is huge at the top end of the table. This could have a real say.
It's unbelievable. I'm really genuinely very excited about the Premier League title race. And that's been the case a few times over the last few seasons, but generally it's been between two teams and generally it's between these two teams. But Arsenal's incredible level of performance and results at the moment means it really does feel like the first three-horse race for a long time. So that means that these games are incredibly important, as they have been in previous seasons, but that they're not the only important thing in the title race. And that's nice as well. So I cannot wait, Dan. Yeah, there's not really much more you can say. If you love football and you love the Premier League, then these games have to be the kind of the pinnacle. And the fact that it's probably, surely, the last time that Klopp and Pep will meet in English football, at least for the foreseeable, that adds a lovely wrinkle to it as well. So, yeah, I'm certainly not jaded by City versus Liverpool, by Pep versus Klopp. I think you have to go the other way and get really excited about this.
Yeah, I mean, and Liverpool have been getting by in recent weeks, Jonathan. Lots of injuries. The players starting to come back now. But they are just finding a way. You know, Salah's going to be back this weekend as well, which is absolutely huge. But I know, you know, there was dodgy circumstances around it last week at Nottingham Forest. But Liverpool deserve huge credit because the amount of times they've won games or rescued games deep into stoppage time this season, it's fascinating.
I mean, vast numbers of points from being behind as well, which... whatever else it says about maybe their defending and how they start games says a lot about their character, their resilience, their spirit. They've maybe been slightly fortunate that the worst of the run of injuries has come at a time when they haven't played too hard a set of fixtures. But at the same time, they've got the results in them and they deserve enormous credit for that. And of course, there's a cup final in the middle of that as well. And you almost wonder if, you know, obviously not by design, but this might have put them in an even better position going forward because suddenly they have had to play a load of these teenagers. Faith has been shown in them. And, yeah, they are responding. Dan's getting the two goals. Bobby Clark looking very good. I thought, you know, when he came on, McConnell, you know, his presence on the ball in that League Cup final, yeah, he looks a proper player. So the fact that their development has maybe been accelerated by this could be a very healthy thing for Liverpool in this title running, but also then for whoever the new manager is going forwards.
It's almost created like a bigger depth in their squad, Ali, because I don't think many people had Bradley as a player that was going to really make an impact this season. Everyone's always said they haven't got an alternative to Trent. Joe Gomez has filled in there, as we've already discussed. But they've created, you know, as Jonathan said, options for now, but also the next manager that's coming in is going to have an embarrassment of riches, and these players are going to have got Premier League minutes under their belt now as well.
Completely. I think, you know, while it was a shock that Klopp has decided to step away, I think there's probably a suggestion that he has done so purposefully this season rather than perhaps last summer, because last summer there was a lot of question marks about Liverpool's squad and its rebuild. And I think you have to say, looking at it now, that A, the recruitment has been good enough over the last two or three windows to pretty solidly rebuild the squad and build a squad that looks pretty sturdy and set to keep getting better over the next few years. And then also what he's done with the academy graduates as well. I think he's pretty much unrivaled amongst top managers for not just sort of talking the talk when it comes to playing young players, but walking the walk, giving them opportunities, believing in them. He's obviously the most incredible motivator and man manager and connects with these guys as well as the fan base. So yeah, it's really boding well for the future. And, you know, you have to be honest and say they're also going to be able to impact the transfer market as they do this summer as well. So it may be the case that they buy some big name players in the same positions as the guys we're talking about. And it may be that we don't see them for another year or two. But even so, as you say, just giving the platform and the belief for the whole academy, that the value that that has for the football club is unbelievable.
Yeah, and I touched on the stoppage time goals, Jonathan. Actually, they are joint in terms of the amount of stoppage time goals scored this season, which has surprised me because it feels like Liverpool would be far and away ahead. Do you want to have a guess at who the team is that's joint top with them with 8?
Spurs.
You see your guess, Ali? You have a guess?
I think maybe Arsenal.
It is Arsenal, but that surprised me. I haven't felt like, I don't remember Arsenal salvaging many games late on, whereas I do for Liverpool and I do for Tottenham, actually. Jonathan's guess as well. I can't think of any games off the top of my head. Unless Arsenal are scoring a lot of like meaningless goals.
I was going to say, garbage time goals, as they call it in basketball. I think that's probably it. And that's, you know, I find the discussion about stoppage time goals fascinating. You know, there's a school of thought that it reflects Liverpool's incredible mentality and Klopp at the heart of that. And it leads to this feeling that there's a sense of fate that in his last season, you know, the emotional aspect of it, they will get over the line and that's why they're scoring late goals. I mean, the really boring thing to say is you shouldn't rely on late goals to win the title because you don't score late goals in every game and it's better to put the game to bed earlier, like, for example, Arsenal have done better this season. So, you know, Arsenal's first half goal difference is plus 20. That is pretty sensational at this stage of the season and they are getting ahead earlier than Liverpool and that's probably better on balance than having the mentality to score the late goals every now and then.
I mean, Chelsea have scored 6 and they're rubbish. So maybe we shouldn't read too much into stoppage time goals. Before we get into Manchester City, Jonathan, just wanted to ask you, who do you think is going to win the league? You've always said City, I believe. Have you had a change of heart?
I mean, look, it's great that with 10 games to go, we've got a 3-horse race, which is the first time since, I think, 2010, possibly 2011, the 3 teams have been this close with 10 matches to go. But I still think City are... They've got the memory of having done it regularly. They've got the probably the deeper squad now with players coming back from injury. They're just relentless. I still feel there's a fragility to both Liverpool and Arsenal. So look, it's great that there's a race, but I still think City will win it. Ask me in 2 weeks when they've played Liverpool and Arsenal. And yeah, I may have a different answer. And what you hope is as well, from a neutral point of view, is that this isn't... I mean, obviously it can't happen because... City have to play both Liverpool and Arsenal. But what you hope is it's not like the race they had when City got the 99 points, Liverpool got the 98. And it wasn't so much a race, it's just quite a quick procession of they just both win the last dozen games of the season. That's not a proper title race. You want teams to drop points, you want twists and turns, you want sort of excitement and narrative rather than this sort of sense of relentless both of them just plodding on. And City win it because they happen to be ahead when that run started.
Yeah. Ali, have you got an answer for me?
I'm probably closer than I've ever been to picking Arsenal, but not really? Just yet. I do think they are just playing unbelievably well. And I'm just aware of the fact that those sorts of runs and level of performance is unlikely to sustain over another 10 or 11 games. But when you watch them at the moment, it seems impossible that they would drop off to a huge extent. So I think they are, you know, just incredible at the moment, but you can't argue with all the points that go in City's favour, and I think that's probably still got to be the pick.
Yeah, I'll pick in City like Jonathan, but I'd quite like it to be Liverpool and Klopp, because I've got so much respect for him. And I think he's so unfortunate not to have won more Premier Leagues with some of the point totals that he's amassed. So in his last season, I would like it to be Liverpool. But it's always hard to bet against City, because they're pretty much nearly every year in the last 5 years, they've won the league, haven't they? So they know what they're doing. And especially at this stage of the season, they know how to manage everything. So it does feel like it will take a lot for City. But great. Sorry for someone but City to win the league, but it is great. I think we've got three teams that are genuinely in the title race. Do you think anyone will fall away before we get to like the final furlongs?
Yeah, I mean, I think both Arsenal and Liverpool are capable of hitting a blip. You only have to hit a blip of two or three games and you're effectively out of it. I think Arsenal remain very much a sort of emotion-driven team that when they're good, they're very, very good, but they're not good when they're bad. And the test of a championship-winning team is a team that can still eke out the victories when they're not playing that well. And it's been a facet of Arteta teams every season, every full season he's had. He's had a little spell in the middle of the season of four or five games where they haven't won. And that has cost them. Now, if you think this season they had that little blip, even if they'd taken five more points, say they'd beaten Fulham and West Ham, the two games they lost, six more points, they're suddenly in a great position now. But then, and in those games, you saw second half of those games, you sort of thought that they'll never score again. Yeah. And then you see them playing, Burnley, Sheffield United recently, and you think they could be getting double figures quite easily. And so I think they're a very sort of emotionally up and down team. Yeah, Liverpool have done well to come through this slough of injuries. Yeah, but still, keeping it going, keeping that emotional pitch together, I think is really difficult. I think, there's two ways of looking at these late wins. Yeah, I mean, Ali alluded to this earlier. On the one hand, it's great. It keeps everybody euphoric. It gives you a boost. But that can't be the only thing you have. And you think back to the Brendan Rodgers season, it fizzled out. It petered away. Even Arsenal last season when they were beating Villa and the 4-3, the Bournemouth game as well. And you sort of thought, this is a sign of champions. And then it fizzles away. So I think that's much more likely to happen for either Arsenal or Liverpool than it is for City. But yeah, it could happen for City as well.
I mean, this is Liverpool City preview, but obviously the title race is relevant. But I don't think Partey coming back and offering a little bit of a different option in Arsenal's midfield may be helpful. I think he's obviously a good player. If you think about Arsenal's midfield last season, which was good in the Premier League, they haven't had Partey or Xhaka, obviously because Xhaka's gone all season. You throw Partey back in with Declan Rice, who's been absolutely brilliant. Odegaard, Havertz has hit a bit of form. Saka's brilliant as always. They're good defensively. Arsenal, there's a lot to be positive about, that there really is. Jonathan, I'll come to you for this one, because Jeremy Doku is playing at the moment. I'm not sure he'd be playing in the big games if Grealish is fit, but I've got to give you your due here, because you said this months ago and I've come around to this school of thought and said it on lots of things that I've been on since as well. Copied you, if you will.
But if I'm right, I'm right.
But taking it as my own.
People have been inspired by Jonathan Wilson's opinion for many decades now, Dan. You're not the first.
Not that many decades. I'm only 47.
Dan, you did make him sound very old there. Decade.
What year was Inverting the Pyramid first published?
2008.
Okay. One and a half.
I would have said. I
know I'm wearing grey, but I'm not Gandalf.
I'm probably more grey than Jonathan underneath the skin fade and whatnot. But yeah, Docker, I tweeted last week that I said Manchester City are a much better team with Jack Grealish in there, because tactically I think he's more switched on. But I do just think Docker holds onto the ball way too long, and I do think that's affecting Haaland.
Yeah, I mean, my issue was always he's great in it. He's great to watch him dribbling, creates a lot against medium to weaker sides in the Premier League. But can he really do it against the top sides, or is he too profligate in possession? So let me give you a stat. I think he's lost the ball 4.6 times per 90 minutes this season. He's successful in just over half his dribbles. Grealish is successful in exactly half his dribbles. And he loses the ball 1.6 times per 90 minutes. So it's not really the proportion, it's the volume. That Doku has given the ball away three times more per game than Grealish. And that is a problem for a club that, or for a team that prioritises control. So to translate that into what does that actually mean? In Premier League games where Doku has started, and you've got to bear in mind, he tends not to have played the biggest games. He did play against Liverpool at the Etihad. He didn't play that Newcastle game right at the beginning of the season when Newcastle had just beaten Villa and it looked like they might be serious challengers. He didn't play the Arsenal game. So he's played, you'd say, slightly easier Premier League games. When he's played, City concede 1.29 goals per game. When he hasn't, it's 0.69. So they concede almost half as many goals when he's not there. And that, I think, is really significant as to do with how often he gives the ball away. So I know Grealish isn't there. I'd be surprised if he plays on Sunday. I think Foden will play on the left. I mean, you could play Bernardo Silva on the left if you want to keep Foden more on the road. He's been playing recently. I think it's unlikely that we'll see Doku start on Sunday.
You think Alvarez perhaps comes in?
He could do. Yeah. I mean, that's another option. I don't think Alvarez had a particularly good season.
No, he started well, didn't he? And then he's kind of faded out. Popped up with the
set pieces
were good for the season.
Yeah, I think his sort of post World Cup hangover, which is natural. I think it's just taken a little bit longer than with other people to kick in. Maybe because he was had the Champions League and everything last season. I mean, he basically finished football last season, didn't he? Won the World Cup, won the Champions League, won the treble. Must be pretty hard to pick yourself up and go again when how old is he? 21, 22?
He's young. I mean, in fairness to him, he didn't win the Carabao Cup, though, did he? Because of Nathan Jones. our Lord and Saviour. Nathan Jones stopped that from happening. Otherwise, he really would have completed football and he might as well have retired. Ali seems to have gone a bit frozen on the screen, but I think he's still there. I've got to speak about Phil Foden, Ali. Absolutely unbelievable in the Manchester derby last season. His numbers this season are a standout as well. Regardless, even before last weekend, I think he's probably been the best player in the Premier League this season. And he's actually my favourite player to watch across the entirety of the Premier League. And has been all season. I just absolutely adore him. How good is he? He's brilliant, isn't he?
He's brilliant. His development has been incredible over the last few years, and now he's just completely exploded this season. I mean, when you compare him to Doku, the level of control that he has, the absolute quality and the football IQ is just completely off the charts. But then he has continued to develop in terms of providing standout moments as a goal threat, which was one of the question marks against his name probably going into this season, and just generally giving Guardiola the level of control that he always desires. That's why I think the Doku experiment, if you like, has been interesting, where by the end of last season, winning every trophy apart from the Carabao Cup, Guardiola had built the most controlled football team I'd ever seen, not just in possession, which has always been a factor of his teams, but out of possession with the physicality that they developed, adding the sort of centre-back profiles into those wide defensive roles, and just the way that they defended in transition was better than ever. And then he's added a specialist in Doku to try and put something extra on top of that level of quality. And it just hasn't worked very well because Doku is a specialist, as Jonathan has explained. He does not, he chips away at that level of control, and that's not good for the team. And he definitely squeezes Haaland and other players, as you mentioned, Dan, because when he cuts inside, he just shuts down space, and he is not a goal threat whatsoever, which I find the worst real, the worst thing about Doku is that he plays for the best team in the world, and he looks like he finds it very difficult to score. So I think Foden should definitely start on that side if that's the question, and I think we'll be enjoying watching him for a long time.
Well, let's look at the combined 11 here, and injured players and unavailable players are excluded from the Who Scored 11. We've got Kelleher in goal. We've got Kyle Walker at right back with Konate, Van Dijk and Robertson joining him in defence. It's an all Manchester City midfield three of Rodri, Bernardo Silva and Kevin De Bruyne, which I don't think anyone could argue with. And then a very, very potent front three with Mo Salah, Haaland and Foden. Best combined 11 team ever there, maybe, Jonathan?
I think it might be. I think that's not far from what I'd have chosen. I would have had Henderson over Kelleher, purely on experience, guys. But Kelleher's had a great season. You can't deny that. I think for once the algorithm has performed its job very, very well.
I think I'd have had Stones in instead of Konate, maybe. But then maybe him and Van Dijk are doing too many of the similar things. I don't know. Ali, you a fan of that 11? I mean, you can't really not be a fan of that 11, let's face it.
Yeah, I liked it. I think I would have had Ake probably over Robertson, just because Robertson's sort of in a slightly in and out campaign, and Ake is just so sturdy in that role. But yeah, otherwise, no great concerns there. I had the same midfield and attack for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, everyone is picking that midfield three, I reckon, of Rodri, Bernardo and Kevin De Bruyne. I don't think anyone picks a different midfield three than that. Something's got to give this weekend, because Liverpool actually haven't lost in the Premier League at home since October 2022. Can either of you remember the opponent?
Man City?
No. You're both going to kick yourself afterwards, I reckon.
I don't know.
Leeds, Jesse DeMarsh. That was the last defeat.
Yeah.
Somerville scored the winner. Somerville scored the winner that day, I believe. So, yeah, something might have to give this weekend, because also Rodri is 59 matches unbeaten.
Which is incredible.
In the Premier League as well. You know, that is a hell of a... Has anyone ever gone that length of time without losing a game? I wouldn't know, but that's...
I'm pretty sure they haven't. I'm pretty sure he broke the record quite a while ago. I sort of seem to remember the weekend when he broke the record. I can't remember whose record it was he took. Anyway, it's a Forest player from... when Clough's Forest had that long run. It was Daniel Story's going to kill me, because he told me when we were in Abidjan.
I would expect you to know this with your decades of experience, Jonathan.
Yeah, it's one of that late 70s Forest team. I can't remember which one. Sorry.
The idea of doing some football trivia with Daniel Story in Abidjan is, you know, I'm pretty jealous of that.
Those nights flew by, those tropical nights.
Well, we're saying something's got to give in this game. Something's got to give in the predictions league as well, because it is getting a lot tighter week by week. I got 9 points last week, which puts me on 168. But Jonathan, Sam got a big 12-point haul for your team.
Oh, fair play. Last week. Yeah, credit where it's due.
It's 159 now. He's been desperate for your credit in the WhatsApp group as well. Because you didn't give him any to begin with when he had a good week a few weeks ago. He's been desperate for some validation from you.
You've got a WhatsApp group. Why am I not in it?
I think we got told you requested not to be in it. I believe the Who Scored papers there. We can put you in. I've got your number now, Jonathan. So
add me in.
I can put you in. When you sent me your number, you thought I'd asked for it and it was someone else, but you just sent it me anyway. So I can get you in that WhatsApp group, Jonathan. And then Ali, George has really given you a tough act to follow this week. Mm. He got a huge 4 points last week.
So, well, that's an absolute shambles. That is a complete shambles.
4 points it had, but we all got 3 points the week when there was no games. You know, that week when there was about five guys, we all only got 3 points. To get four in a 4 week of fixtures, I can only presume that George didn't submit all his games. That's an awful score. So predictions are big this week. It is getting tight, especially.
So what? Is 9 point gap, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's closer than it's been all season, that is.
Yeah.
So, Jonathan, I'll come to you first. What's your prediction?
1-1.
1-1. Ali?
That's my prediction as well, 1-1.
I've gone for 2-1 to Liverpool at Anfield. Yes, it could be a swing there. Obviously, you know, that's a huge game in the Premier League weekend, as we all know.
I should just say, I think Liverpool need to win this if you're going to win the title.
Do you?
I think because of the strength of City's squad, I think Liverpool need to put a bit of clear water between them and City. And also, if they do win that, you know, that makes the gap 4 points. I mean, Arsenal should go top if they beat Brentford on Saturday. But just between Liverpool and City, a 4 point gap then means a City going to the Arsenal game the following week, not really able to drop points, because they can't risk that 4 points becoming six or seven. So just for the sake of putting pressure on City, for the sake of having the advantage of having their game against City that remains at Anfield, I think Liverpool really, they need to win this more than City need to win it.
Yeah, I mean, this game's huge, as I've just said before Jonathan interrupted my excellent segue into the next game.
Sorry.
This game is massive, but there's an even bigger game. The race for the top four, Aston Villa against Tottenham. Ali, I think we can possibly discount Manchester United now. Spurs have got a game in hand on Villa. There's currently a 5 point gap, but it does feel like this one at Villa Park could be huge for the race for fourth. And it actually, fifth may end up being enough for Champions League football as well.
I'm pleased for English football that there might be five English teams in the Champions League next season. But I'm disappointed, purely looking at this game, that appears that it will be the case. Because if there was only four spots, then this would have a huge, huge implications on who would reach that. And both for Spurs and obviously for Aston Villa, you know, if it was four spots and it was between the two of them, you know, it would be completely massive for both football clubs. As it is, I think we can probably assume that there will be five. I've spoken to a friend, Aurel, who works for 21st Group, who are a data intelligence firm, and he said that their projections are that they believe it will be five Champions League spots for England, as long as the English teams do well in Europe this season, which they normally do. So that's a bit of a shame. But even so, it's important. Based on what Aurel sent me, if Aston Villa win, 21st Group reckon 94% chance of a top five spot. So, you know, in an unbelievably strong position. And if they lose and if Spurs win, Villa's chance of the top five spot goes down to 75%, so 3 and 4, and Spurs would go up to 85%. So, I mean, either way, both teams should, and you would suggest will make it in because they are significantly better football teams than Manchester United, and they have the points advantage at the moment. But I'll be really interested to see how this one plays out, I must say.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan, you're such an influencer because every time you've took a sip of water, I've got it. You've reminded me that I've got a water here for a change. I've done the same, using your decades of experience on the waterfront. Two really good football teams in this game on Sunday. I think that's the key thing, isn't it? That both of these teams, they won't really change how they play this weekend, which leads me to believe it'll be an entertaining game.
Should be, yeah. I mean, this is the super Sunday we've had for quite a long time, I think, of two games that I really, really want to watch. And yeah, I'm doing the Arsenal game on Saturday, so I've got Sunday off. And I plan to kind of... It's early, isn't it? It's 1 o'clock the kickoff. Is that right, on Sunday? But it's earlier than usual. But yeah, I'm looking forward to tucking into my lunch while watching that and then slumping on the sofa the rest of the afternoon. It's I guess the game is in the right order. The undercard is on first, but the undercard should be very entertaining because they're two great teams to watch.
I mean, your day sounds brilliant. I obviously don't want to go to Villa Park. I want to do the same thing that you're doing. What time is the kickoff of the second game?
It's 3:45. It's been brought forward for security reasons. There's been some funny times of Sunday fixtures recently because it was 3:30 last weekend, wasn't it? I don't know what's going on. But I mean, last season we started moving games around for US summertime, didn't we? Because it kicks in a different time to ours. Which, come on.
Yeah, like, that's bizarre. You can't be doing that.
I don't know if that was the reason last week. I've no idea. But yeah, 3:30, then 3:45. But the truth is, 4:30 is too late.
Yeah, it's true.
I've done a few 3 o'clock games in London recently. And God, they did get it right, the people in the past, didn't they? 3 o'clock on a Saturday is actually the best time for a game. Because you can have your morning, have a nice bit of lunch, go to the ground, get your work done. You're coming home for dinner, or you can have a couple of pints on the way home if you want. It's just a nice day.
Yeah. Well, no, I agree with you. I mean, let's talk about Leon Bailey, Ali. I mean, I knew there was a good player there. I've got to say, I wasn't sure we were ever going to see Aston Villa after a couple of iffy seasons. Villa signed Diaby in the summer, and I'm thinking, well, Leon Bailey's not in Villa's best 11. First half of the season, he did everything he could to get himself into that 11, coming off the bench, making an impact, and now he's a guaranteed starter. 8 goals, 8 assists from 1,300 minutes. He's having a hell of a season.
Yeah, exceptional numbers. As you say, it took him a while to punch his way into Emery's sort of clear starting 11. But the last 3 months, he's been one of the best attacking players in the league, hasn't he? And I wonder if there's, you know, you'll know from being a Villa fan, Dan, but it seemed like you were suggesting that previously with Bailey, you'd seen flashes of quality, but not enough consistency and possibly not impacting the game as regularly as you'd want from a wide attacker like him. Maybe that's just the sort of player that he is and the sort of role that he plays. Sometimes guys like this go through incredible hot streaks. You know, he is, over the course of the season, scoring 1 in 5 shots. So 20% conversion rate, which for a wide forward who's often cutting in and taking shots that aren't exactly high probability, high XG shots, is an astounding conversion rate. It's also the sort of conversion rate that rarely sustains over a much longer period of time. So I think we should celebrate the fact that he's having an unbelievable patch of form and combining very well with Ollie Watkins. It's probably a style of play that really suits him, and attacking in transition is clearly attacking space is exactly what someone like him is going to want to be doing. And he's playing for a great team. So it's all come together. And yeah, credit to him. It's been great to watch.
I mean, you're saying he's combining with Ollie Watkins. They've actually got they've combined for the most goals together across the entirety of the Premier League. 7 goals. And they're both in the top 10 in the Who Scored form rankings table. So we've got Saka at first, Ødegaard second, then Ollie Watkins, Kai Havertz, Declan Rice, Phil Foden sixth, Rodri, Alexis McAllister, Leon Bailey and Gabriel Martinelli. So it's a very top four centric top 10 there for the Who Scored form rankings. Jonathan, just a word on Ollie Watkins from you. Clinical again last week at Luton. Has taken his game to new heights under Unai Emery. I think both of them deserve a huge amount of credit. Emery for kind of refining Watkins' game, and Watkins for being able to just diligently carry out the instructions that Unai Emery wants from his centre forward. Is he now genuinely the second best striker in the Premier League?
Second best striker after Haaland. I mean, arguably, he's better than Haaland in terms of chance conversion at the minute. But I mean, you know,
stop it, Jonathan.
I think he is, isn't he? I can't think of anybody else. I was thinking this last night watching Leipzig, and how Cesco, when he gets a one-on-one, just looks like he has no idea how to score. And this comes having watched Timo Werner last week, and I know, you know, he took his goal really well. That movement was great, but the one-on-one he had in the first half. That first chance when Son slips him through and he runs the entire length of the half and the Palace half, and never for a second looked like he was going to score. And then you think of how sometimes, I mean, Nunez, sometimes, yeah, he can score those dinks like he did at Brentford, but also the times when you sort of think, this guy's not even going to get in the box before he falls over. And it's really weird how there's this class of actually clearly really very good modern centre-forwards who don't look like they're going to score. When you compare that to, say, Son's goal, the third goal against Palace for Tottenham, or the second Watkins goal at Luton, where you could see exactly what he was going to do incredibly early. You could see he was just going to open his body, he's just going to bend it round, and that even though the space was small, you had no doubt that he was going to hit it. And it is incredible how just the confidence of the players run, or the confidence is visible in the players run. And then even that shot he had, I thought almost more impressive in his goals in terms of just how well he's playing at the minute, was the shot that hit the post. That's not a position from which you have any right to be hitting the post. You know, those don't often threaten the goal from, you know, when you're sort of, you're running on an angle away from goal and you're hooking the ball back across the keeper. And that was, it was 2 inches from going in and being another brilliant finish. So yeah, he's on form. He's almost better than Haaland at the minute, I'd say.
I mean, he's got this really clever way about him at the moment. Just thinking back to that shot that you're talking about, where he does manage to shift the ball in tight situations in the box and get shots off, and he usually hits the target as well. He's become such a great finisher, so many different facets to his game. Ali, you'll have seen a lot of him in the EFL as well, I'm going to guess, and played a lot of time out wide there as well. Did you ever envisage him getting to the heights that he's got to? And do you think he would have got to these heights without Unai Emery?
I'll try and take those in order. No, you cannot. No one, even the Exeter Academy coaches who developed him initially and would have known he was an incredible talent, you cannot say you predicted this, for a few reasons. Partly because the journey that he has been on from League Two to being arguably the best striker in the Premier League is almost unprecedented, particularly in the last decade or two. You know, the EFL has if you look at the England squad, you will find that the majority of England star players have played in the EFL when they were young, but increasingly that is loans from Premier League teams rather than, you know, you've still got your John Stones, your Harry Maguires, etc., who do start at Championship League One clubs, but you know, that it's unsurprising that as the top clubs hoover up young British talent, you know, that is getting harder and harder to do. So the journey he's been on is basically unprecedented. I think it's one of the best stories in football in the last 10 years. And the second point being, they can't have seen this coming because, as you've said, he played left wing or right wing for Exeter. He was playing in League Two, where in those roles, you're nowhere near the centre of the penalty box. You're not occupying central defenders like he does better than almost anyone in the world right now. You're not scoring poachers' goals, which he's doing, as you've said, so well right now. He was just doing different things. So the adaptability and the improvement in different positions has been absolutely incredible. For Brentford, he played left wing, I think, in his first season, right wing in his second season. And then when they sold Mopai, they redeveloped him as a striker. So I think he couldn't have done it without the clubs that he's played for happening to be some of the better development clubs that exist in English football. Brentford have an unbelievable record on this front. So I think, you know, Brentford probably get a lot of credit for turning him into a striker. And then Emery, I mean, you can't argue with how he's looked over the last year. So for sure, I honestly think it's one of the most amazing stories in English football in the last decade. And never get tired of talking about him, which we seem to every week on this show. Surprised with a Villa fan hosting it.
I mean, to be fair, it's been my life talking about him at the moment, because everything I go on, they want to talk about Ollie Watkins. And then obviously I do Villa stuff as well, where I have to talk about Ollie Watkins because he's that good. I'm obviously quite biased, as we've just discovered. Just before we get into Tottenham, Jonathan, who do you think is the better team out of these two? If you had to pick one for fourth now, who would you pick? Because obviously I have in my head that I think Villa are better than Spurs and Manchester United, but I'm aware that also I may be a little bit biased.
Well, there's no doubt that Manchester United are the worst of those three.
Oh, 100%.
Villa are, what, 5 points clear with a game in hand, is that right?
Spurs have got a game in hand, yeah.
So yeah, Spurs have got a game in hand, so yeah, that's what I meant, yeah. I don't know, I mean, the thing is, they're both capable of playing really, really good football. I don't fully trust either of them. I mean, I've seen a fair amount of Spurs live this season, and the pattern seems quite similar every time I see them, which is they have loads of the ball, don't really create anything, go behind, and then somehow win the game by scoring a couple of goals in the last 15 minutes. Which, you know, it's a bit like the Liverpool question. Is that evidence of their great fitness and great mental strength? Or is it sort of a bit of a getting out of jail every week? And I'm not sure. Equally, Villa, I think, you know, Villa going into December were playing brilliant, brilliant football. That performance against City is one of the, you know, maybe the best ones I've ever seen against City in the league by any team. But I think particularly second half of the Arsenal game onwards, they looked a bit tired, looked a bit jaded. Results dipped away. Now, they have come back a bit, but they still seem to be conceding a lot of goals. I don't quite trust them. You know, you tune up at Luton. I know it's Luton who've got a habit of coming back, but still, you should be able to just hold them at arm's length when you tune up. And Villa couldn't do that. And it becomes, you know, a bit of a dogfight in the last sort of 10 minutes or so. So who's better? I think they're both going to qualify for Champions League, because I think even though England is still third in the coefficient table for this season, they do have two more teams left than Germany. I don't think any of the Italian teams are actually much cop, so I think it won't matter. I think they will both get in the Champions League, and that is my cop-out answer.
Ali, have you got a more firmer answer than that?
No, I think they're incredibly well matched. I think that if you look at the whole season in terms of the underlying numbers just outside of the league table, which we can all see for ourselves, very, very similar sort of XG ratio and things of that nature. Recently, Spurs' numbers have been a little bit stronger over the last month, 2 months. Villa obviously missing so many key players that there's mitigating circumstances for that. So with Konsa back in particular, I think neck and neck, and I'd certainly lean towards Villa for fourth spot at the moment.
Yeah, Pau Torre should hopefully be back in on Sunday as well, whether or not he plays against Ajax tonight. I think if he doesn't and he's sat on the bench, that means he's been saved for Sunday against Tottenham, and he's pivotal to the way Emery wants Villa to play. And he, honestly, I can't tell you how good Pau Torres is. Let's talk about Tottenham then. And Jonathan, we've talked about Ollie Watkins there as this clinical striker. Let's talk about Timo Werner. Scored last week for Tottenham. He does a lot of stuff, actually, Timo Werner, that I really, really like. But it's fair to say he doesn't have the clinical edge of Ollie Watkins. If you were the Spurs manager and you were given the option to get him in for £15 million at the end of the season, would you take that option?
I think I probably would. I mean, I don't think £15 million is not a lot for a forward these days. His work ethic is incredible. He works incredibly hard. I mean, he was very, very popular at Chelsea because fans could see, he worked incredibly hard. He never goes hiding, misses a chance, comes back, misses another chance. And I still sort of think it could happen again. Like he had that season at Leipzig when he got the 29 goals, I think it was, he got one season. Maybe if he just gets on the run, maybe if he gets a bit of confidence, that will come again. I think his link-up with Son is really good, the way that Son is, likes dropping off, feeding those balls. So in the way that Kane used to do, that really suits Werner. He's quick. I think he's unselfish. You have the game at United, which was his debut for Spurs. He got an assist that day. Missed a couple of really bad chances, or missed a couple of chances really badly. but still was sort of vital in getting the draw for Spurs, set up a goal. So I think he's, you know, if you look at every attribute apart from his finishing, and obviously the finishing is the thing that as a forward is the most obvious, but every attribute apart from his finishing, he is really, really good. And so on that basis, and the fact I think he's just good in the squad. I don't think he's somebody you kick up a fuss if he was dropped for a couple of weeks. I think 15 million for a player coming into his late 20s, coming into his prime, you know, a player who, yeah, pretty confident what he can do, and you still have that hope that maybe he can have a golden season of 15, 20, 25 goals, maybe not 25. I think it's worth a gamble. 15 million is just not a lot of money these days.
Mm. Yeah, someone that was a lot of money was Brennan Johnson for 50 million, I think it was, Ali. Turned into quite a useful impact sub in recent weeks. He's actually, in terms of goal involvement as a sub, second across the entirety of the Premier League with five. Mm-hmm. It's actually Leon Bailey who's top with six because he made a lot of sub appearances at the start of the season. Guess obviously you don't want to spend £50 million on someone who is purely an impact player. But I guess Spurs, although they've lost Harry Kane, they do have a lot of different types of forward players now to come on and change games. And I think that's probably been a contributing factor to why they won games late recently.
For sure. You don't want to be spending 50 million quid on a sub player, but the very top teams increasingly are doing that. And in Spurs' case, they have to be trying to get to the very top of the Premier League. And in doing so, they are going to necessarily build a really strong squad. I think what you've alluded to there, Dan, is kind of the most interesting part of this discussion about Werner and Johnson for me, and that's just about player profiles and making sure that in your squad you have different types of attacker for different situations, particularly as Spurs under Postecoglou quite clearly developing to being a high possession-based team. They are a team that, therefore, in the majority of their matches will be trying to break down low-block defences. And they've really struggled to do that at times this season. And so when you're building a squad and an attacking team like that, they are going to prioritise a certain amount of players who are really comfortable in possession against that sort of team and want the ball to feet and sort of thrive on that. But then you also want the other side. You need players who offer you off-ball movement and runs in behind, particularly from wide areas to central areas. Of course, you know, Son's development means that Postecoglou can use him in a ton of different ways. And I think with Johnson and with Werner, you know, it is really important for them to have players like this who actually you don't want them touching the ball at all, ideally, until they are inside the box, either shooting or getting to the byline and fizzing the ball across. So it's kind of the beauty of squad building. I think it's why Werner at 15 million, because it is so cheap for a club like Spurs as a squad player, is a good thing. And it's why 50 million for Johnson seems a bit steep, because he's definitely not someone that I would think is a comfortable kind of low block breaker, if you like. He is better suited to coming off the bench and probably games against the top teams. And there's a lot of value in that as well. We've seen him play in quite a lot of the big games this season, because that's when Spurs have a very rare opportunity to attack on the break in transition regularly. And that's where Johnson clearly, when he pins his ears back and can sprint in behind, is at his most threatening.
Well, let's look at the combined 11 from who scored then. It's absolute baloney because there's only four Villa players in this 11. We've got Vicario in goal, Pedro Porro, who's one of my favourite players in the Prem, at right back, Romero, Van de Ven and Luca Dean complete the back four. It is a 4-4-2, by the way. We've got Kulusevski, Maddison, Douglas Luiz and John McGinn as the midfield four. I'd argue that you'd have to swap McGinn and Maddison around in that system. And then up top, it's Ollie Watkins and Son, which I don't think is too difficult to disagree with. Although I've got to say, we've just been raving about Leon Bailey through the Who Scored metrics, and then he doesn't make the Who Scored 11, which I find bizarre. But apparently there was a reason for that, I was told. But then I was not given the reason in the WhatsApp group. So we'll have to investigate that later when Jonathan joins the WhatsApp group. We'll finish, as we always do, with a prediction then. What are we predicting for this one, guys? Ali, I'll come to you first.
I'm going to predict a 2-2 draw.
2-2 draw. Jonathan?
2-1 to Villa.
And I've done exactly the same, 2-1 to Villa. And I have just been informed by Who Scored that Leon Bailey's made too many appearances from the bench, and that's affected his rating, and that's why he hasn't made the combined 11. So let's do the rest of our predictions. Obviously, you know, the title race, top four, there's huge things going on this weekend, but there's nothing bigger really than the predictions leg here. It is getting incredibly tight. Jonathan, Manchester United against Everton.
2-1 to United.
2-1 to United. I have gone for 1-1. Ali?
0-0.
0-0. Nice work, Ali. There we go. Bournemouth against Sheffield United, Ali?
2-0 to Bournemouth.
I've gone 4-0. Bournemouth, Jonathan?
Also 2-0 to Bournemouth.
2-0 to Bournemouth. Crystal Palace against Luton, please, Jonathan?
1-0 to Palace.
I've gone 2-1 to Palace. Ali?
1-1.
1-1. Then Wolves v Fulham, please, Ali?
2-1 to Fulham.
2-1 to Fulham. Fulham are on a bit of a run at the moment, but I've gone for Wolves 2, Fulham 2. Jonathan?
1-1.
1-1. Arsenal against Brentford, please, Jonathan?
2-0 to Arsenal.
2-0 to Arsenal, 3-1 to Arsenal here. David Raya can't play in that one, can he? So it'd be Ramsdale in goal. Ali?
4-1 to Arsenal.
4-1 Arsenal. We've done Villa Spurs, of course. Brighton against Forest, please, Ali.
I'm going for 1-1 here.
I've done exactly the same as
Brighton you. Brighton against Forest, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, what did I say?
I think you said Spurs, but I might have, I might have glitched.
Brighton v Forest it is. So me and Ali have both gone for 1-1. Jonathan?
Brighton to win it 2-1.
Brighton to win 2-1 there. West Ham against Burnley, please, Jonathan.
2-0 to West Ham.
3-0 to West Ham here. Ali?
2-1.
2-1 to West Ham. There's a lot of different scores this week. Could be a really interesting week. We've done Liverpool against Manchester City, so we'll finish with Chelsea against Newcastle. Ali?
I'm going for a 1-0 win to Newcastle.
1-0 to Newcastle. I've gone for 2-0 to Newcastle at Stamford Bridge, Jonathan.
I've gone 2-1 to Chelsea.
2-1 to Chelsea. I tell you what, there's a big spread this week. It's going to be an exciting weekend all round. I'll be keeping my eyes glued to the scores. But then I never like to go back and have to listen to all the predictions on the podcast to know what they are. So I need them written down somewhere so I can do
Maybe somebody could write them down and put them in the WhatsApp group that I've been barred from.
Now you're getting in. I'm going to put you, the first thing I do when I get off this podcast is I'm going to put you, I'm not an admin, so I probably don't have the rights. And I think I'm the only one who's got your number. So I'll have to get you put in. Ali, are you in the WhatsApp group, Ali?
I'm not in the WhatsApp group and I do not want to be in the WhatsApp group.
That's fair.
Thank you for the offer. I'm already in, I think, 135 WhatsApp groups with George Ellick and I don't want to be in anymore.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I can understand that. That's completely fair. Right then, thank you very much to you both for joining me on this week's show. I really enjoyed myself and hopefully the audience has enjoyed it as well. Wherever you are digesting the podcast, whether it be video or audio, do all the things that help the podcast grow, help us appear in places we may not necessarily appear without you liking, commenting and subscribing. Please do all those good things for the show. Yeah, thank you to Ultimate Fan for sponsoring us as well. Enjoy all the football at the weekend and don't forget to tell all your friends and family about the show.